You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, I'm Karen Shook, books editor of Times Higher Education, and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education books podcast. I'm delighted and honored to have an eminent Dantean in the studio. My guest today is Prue Shaw, emeritus reader in Italian studies at University College London, and perhaps more importantly for today's purposes, author of a brilliant book, Reading Dante, From Here to Eternity. It's our book of the week. Our reviewer said a number of very flattering things about it, and she wasn't the only person. A review in the Dallas News, Tim Redmond, said it was a stunning achievement. And he argued that when you're reading the comedy, the commedia, as I suppose I should say, the Inferno is good for the young, Purgatory is good for the middle-aged, and Paradiso for the old. Prue, any thoughts on that?
Oh, golly, that's a hard one to start with. No, I don't see it that way at all. I think anybody can read the whole poem. I wouldn't. Did he really say that? I don't remember him saying that. Yeah.
But I could I could sort of see the lurid punishments appealing to the
You can think of the Inferno as a kind of medieval equivalent of a horror movie, and if we think horror movies are for young people, then perhaps it has an appeal for young people. But it's very punitive and it's very judgmental. I'm not sure that young people are into that particularly.
Well, I've got a confession to make, and I think a lot of academics have told me about what it's like going to dinner parties when you speak to someone and say you're a scholar. And if you're a mathematician, you get people making confessions about how bad they were at sums. And if you're physicists, people try to change the subject. I expect if you're a Dante scholar at a British dinner party, there's a markedly different sort of reception than if you were at an Italian dinner party. Would that be true?
I think it's a conversation closer in England. I think people really have nowhere to go with it, whereas in Italy that wouldn't be true. Obviously in Italy everybody knows the commedia, everybody has an opinion. Everybody can quote, whether they talk about it at dinner parties, I'm not so sure. They quote naturally and without embarrassment. I was very touched, for example, on a Start the Week program about a year ago. Bertolucci, the film director, was being interviewed, and he simply started quoting Dante. It was completely wonderful. Three of my favorite lines from the Inferno, and he just said them absolutely unselfconsciously, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Obviously, that can only happen, I suppose, in Italy or with an Italian. But it's hard to think of an English person on Start the Week necessarily breaking into an English poem and assuming that the readers would instantly know what it was and why he was quoting it.
So my confession, of course, as you will know, is that I'm one of the people you've written this book for.
Well, that's great. That's really nice to be talking to somebody who might be potentially a reader.
I think a lot of people who think of themselves as bookish and well-read and interested in culture, who've looked at a few paintings in the Uffizi and who've traveled, still have an embarrassing gap when it comes to one of the greatest works of literature in the Western world.
I think that's absolutely true. And those are the very people that I've written the book for, or that's the main category of people I've written the book for. Perhaps I should say I haven't written it for academics and I haven't written it for students. I haven't written it for academics in the sense that I've very deliberately avoided using academic jargon or literary theory because I know a lot of, let's call them ordinary readers, find that very off-putting. And I haven't done a kind of potted history for students where they think they can read this book and they know everything about Dante, they don't actually need to read him, which is the way some handbooks for students work, I think, or tend to work, or students tend to use them that way. So it's written for the general reader. It's who knows nothing about Dante, if you like, but knows he's out there, knows that they should try and come to grips with him. It's also written for another possibly smaller category of readers who think they do know Dante,
right,
but actually, in my view, have got him wrong.
And would these be people who had read the comedy?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is to that one, but can I illustrate that with an anecdote? I'd like to tell you a little anecdote about Peter Porter, who's an Australian poet, very good Australian poet, sadly no longer with us. lovely man, very widely read, and a great lover of all things Italian. And in his last book of poetry, he wrote a little poem on Dante. It's a beautifully crafted little poem, but it has one line in it which just stopped me in my tracks when I read it. And the line was, it was about the comedy, "A text for scholar dogs to roll upon."
Oh,
and
no.
I thought, oh my goodness, I'm a Dante scholar. Am I a scholar dog? In what sense do I roll upon the text? What does Peter mean? What is he saying here? So I bailed him up the next time I saw him and I said, come on, Peter, explain to me what this line means, "a text for scholar dogs to roll upon." And he laughed very disarmingly and he said, "Prue, I haven't the faintest idea what I meant when
poet.
I wrote that." Exactly. I really don't know what I meant. And I said, "But it sounds as if you don't like Dante." And he said, "No, I don't." And I said,
"Really?
Why is that?" And he said, "Because he's spiteful and vindictive."
Oh.
And I thought, "Peter, you're so wrong. That's just not what Dante's like." But I couldn't back him into a corner and bend his ear at that point. It would have been very inappropriate in the circumstances. And it just made me think somebody should write a book which, for starters, says Dante's not spiteful, vindictive, sadistic, or whatever other words one, a hasty reading of the Inferno might lead you to.
People flicking say, through a list
people
of people being tortured.
Seeing these
and
gruesome
so on.
Punishments and so on, you might, you know, it's the horror movie aspect, but that's really the least important aspect in a way.
My goodness. And what about those of us who think, well, I remember doing a bit of Milton and that seemed like hard going, and reading anything in translation is bound not to be good. And he was writing this in the 14th century. What can it possibly mean to me? Even those of us who think Shakespeare, oh, universal truths.
Okay, let's start with your comment about Milton. Dante's language is nothing like Milton. Let me say that right away. Milton is pitched very, very high, very Latinate, very difficult. I think readers reading today find him really extraordinarily difficult and impenetrable. Whereas Dante, as I think I say in the book, 80% of Dante's text is immediately intelligible to an Italian now. And some of it is, it could have been said today. I mean, it's very colloquial,
really?
Very spontaneous. So the Milton argument, I don't think, holds good. The foreign language argument, obviously, is a powerful one, and most English readers might not have attempted Dante because they're thinking, I'm reading in translation and I'm losing a huge amount. Obviously, you do lose something, but I think there's so much still to be gained reading him, even in translation, that people should give it a go. And what I've tried to do in the book is quote almost invariably what I think are very powerful and beautiful lines and give a very simple, my English translation, prose translation, immediately below it, so that anyone reading the book, if they really feel they can't cope with the Italian, can skip straight to the translation. But what I would hope is that they would have a go at matching the translation to the Italian, and I think they would find often that it's less difficult than they might have thought.
Not as intimidating as they've been told. Well, so the genesis of this book, you mentioned that it's informed certainly by your years of studying and teaching Dante.
Yeah.
But there's quite a distinct shift between writing for scholars and working for scholars and having to address a general audience. It obviously must be appealing to an academic because you like to disseminate your love of a subject, but it is a audience who will not know even the basics that maybe a first-year undergraduate might.
Okay, well, that's absolutely true. And I think the distinction you're making between the kind of audience I've addressed in the past and the kind of audience I'm trying to reach now is a crucial one, particularly because of the kind of academic work that I've always done, because most of my scholarly activity has been concerned with manuscripts and textual editing, which is possibly the most arcane
and the most necessary.
inaccessible part of literary scholarship for the general public to get to grips with. So it was a complete change of gear for me to think, at the end of my career, I've taught Dante all these years, I've taught students, I've got a huge amount out of that. Peter Porter thinks Dante's no good, not worth bothering with.
There must be a few more of them out there.
I must do something to try and reach an audience and forget the textual stuff. Just say, look, this is a great poet. You really should try and read this poet. Give it a go.
Was it more or less difficult than you expected, that kind of presentation of the work?
I had a very clear idea in mind of the way, the kind of way that I might do it. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to do it, but I gave a lecture when the Botticelli illustrations of the Divine Comedy were on at the Royal Academy. I think it was in 2000. I gave a lecture there, and that was the first time I thought, I'm really not talking to academics, I'm not talking to students, I'm talking to the general public. I have to find a way of saying this. Try and get them interested. Try and make them see that actually it's completely fascinating, and it's just as interesting today as ever it was, as it was when he wrote it.
Did it work?
Did the book work?
Did the lecture work?
The lecture worked. Yeah, no, the lecture was fine. I was pleased with the lecture. I mean, I think if the lecture hadn't worked, I would never have thought that I could go on and do a book. But it was just the idea of talking to a different audience and in a slightly different way, stripping off all the sort of encrustation of academic discourses, they say. Discourse is the word. Jargon, literary theory, whatever. And I had a great help in that with my older daughter, who is a voracious reader, and who read through the final draft with the red pencil and simply marked things that she said too academic, too stuffy, yuck. Was her worst comment. Her most damning comment. And so it was just little tweakings. And I don't know, you tell me if it's managed to be not too academic.
Well, what I thought was most interesting, obviously, was the structure of the book. As you say, a lot of guides to reading Dante, the sort of hand-holding guides, which have a place in scholarship.
Sure.
Every undergraduate offers up a prayer to gods.
Yeah.
But rather than saying, here we are in hell, later purgatory, then paradise.
No, that's exactly what I didn't want to do. That's what I wanted to avoid.
Focusing on friendship, power, life, love, time, numbers, words. I found it surprising. What I liked was the feeling that I could, in reading it, focus on subjects that were interesting. And you're very tactful at drawing in highlights and interesting points of the book. So I don't feel that I'm constantly playing catch up, because I must confess, haven't read it.
Yeah. Haven't read it yet, Karen.
Yeah,
I will be reading it.
How did you confine yourself to those seven? Were there loads of other subject candidates sticking their hands up?
Well, it grew in part out of, and this really does link back to my teaching. I taught a final honours year course on purgatory for several years before I retired at UCL. And the way I got the students into it, because they were students actually who already knew Dante, had done some Dante before, and I wanted to think of a different way of engaging them, and not, we're going to start at the beginning and we're going to work methodically through. So I came up with some of these ideas, and I gave them to the students to do as seminar, as presentations to come along. And it was always an incredibly interesting and fruitful and productive way of working with them, because they would bring all sorts of things to it, not necessarily even things that I had thought they would bring to it. And from that, all sorts of other stuff emerged. And so some of these themes that I've got there actually grew out of that.
Students are useful.
Students are very useful, and students can be a lot of fun to teach.
But what? Yeah. There are 14,000 lines.
14,233.
I'm sorry. I knew there was a value in having. Thank you. Approximately 14,000.
Approximately 14,000. Yeah.
What do students struggle with most in your experience, whether it's undergraduates, postgraduates? What not line 1,223. I mean, but what seems most alien, or what things seemed problematic over the years in ways that surprised you?
I think they, at least to start with, possibly often think of it as just a kind of catalogue of sins and punishments. These are the bad things you can do in life.
Here's what you
this
get.
Is what's going to happen to you.
Upside down.
Yeah, whatever.
In the ice.
And although, obviously, that's a dimension of it, it seems to me that that's not the most interesting or illuminating way to think about it. I think it's much more interesting to think of it as Dante's voyage. I mean, Dante, obviously, Dante does the journey. He goes down into hell, he climbs the mountain of purgatory, he goes through the heavens and he has the vision of God at the end. So it is a journey, but there's a moral and psychological counterpart to the physical journey. It's a journey in knowledge and understanding. So the transformation of Dante, the character, through his encounters with the souls of the dead, is one of the most engrossing and interesting dimensions to the text. There are two other things I can say about that, maybe. It's Dante. Dante's an individual. He's not a generic Christian. He's not like Christian
in Pilgrim's Progress.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he doesn't just have the generic characteristics of Christian. He's very much himself, and he's recognized by the souls of the dead for all sorts of things. The clothes he's wearing identify him as a Florentine. The way he speaks identifies him as a Tuscan, and for those with a very sharp ear, a Florentine, and so on. So it's an extremely personal thing, and there are two strands in particular where he evolves, and by the end of the poem, he's a completely changed person, obviously in a moral and spiritual sense, because he starts off in a psychological and spiritual predicament. He's in the dark wood. But two strands that perhaps are less obvious are in the course of the poem, he receives a political education. He starts with certain views about the way society should work and what his role should be. In the political sphere, he ends up with a completely different view. It's a political education enacted through his encounters over the course of the poem. And then the other thing that's equally interesting, and in some ways I think even more gripping, in the course of the poem, he becomes the poet who is capable of writing the poem, which he wasn't when he started. He has to have completed the journey. In our end is our beginning. He gets to the end of the journey and then he has to start writing the poem. So by his encounter with, among other things, poets in the course of the journey, he's become a different poet. So it's an evolving thing. It's a transformative experience. It isn't just a catalogue of sins and these are the nasty things that are going to happen to you.
And if you're lucky, you'll be in limbo with Peter.
If you're very lucky, you're in limbo, but it's a pretty remote possibility, I think.
So you and Dante go way back. Is that fair to say?
As a young scholar? A fair thing to say. I mean, I went to Florence for my first postgraduate degree, and I was privileged to follow courses by three extraordinarily brilliant and eminent Italian scholars, all of whom were Dantisti, all of whom wrote about Dante and worked on Dante. I don't know whether you want me to
I'd talk. Love to hear about them. What did they think of this nice young Australian woman who'd come over?
I don't know what they thought. That's a difficult question.
Were there many foreign students there when you were there?
There were very, very few. I had a lovely friend from Holland who'd come to study, and I had Italian friends from outside of Florence who had come, one in particular who'd come to study. It's very difficult to meet Florentines. Florentines are very choosy, as they say. They're closed in, they're not, or they weren't then. They've probably changed a lot since then. But there was a contingent of Americans from Middlebury College who were doing an MA. But they were only there for sort of 7 or 8 months. They didn't really plug in and do a degree the way that I did. So no, there were foreigners there, but there weren't very many. There weren't very many. It's not the way it is now, where students are traveling all over Europe.
It must have been quite an adventure to leave home and head to Italy, knowing that you weren't just going for 3 months or 6 months.
I'd won a scholarship and I wanted
to keep it. A very prestigious scholarship, I understand.
I wanted to keep the scholarship. I certainly didn't want to, give up and go home. It was very, very difficult. It was extraordinarily lonely to start with. But that's the way I learned Italian. I lived in an Italian pensione. There were only mostly Italians there. I had to speak Italian. So my Italian dramatically improved. And by the end of the first year, because all exams in Italy are oral exams. So by the end of the first year, I was doing oral exams in Romance philology. And Italian literature and all sorts of other things.
But did you speak Italian already when you left?
No, I'd studied Italian, but I really wasn't fluent. I mean, I arrived in Florence with the head start that I already knew the grammar, I knew the language, I knew how it worked, but I really hadn't I hadn't had any very much experience at speaking it. So, and it was interesting that some of the lecturers I could understand instantly. I mean, there was a lovely lecturer on Italian literature who looked like Fellini and spoke with extraordinary clarity and whatever, and I could, and he wasn't teaching Dante, sadly, he was teaching Leopardi, but it was wonderful. But there were other people, the people that I really wanted to get to grips with were much harder to understand. So, you know, the first few weeks, my lecture notes were extremely...
Small notes saying, help!
A lot of question marks, because I wasn't sure if I was even recognizing the words.
But already you were interested in studying
Dante. Oh, I was
Dante. You had made
I already
that
knew
decision.
That these were the courses I wanted to do.
And this was, you studied at the University of Sydney for your first degree in English and Italian.
Yeah.
How did you come to Italian? Do you have a family background? Do you have any Italian ancestors?
Well, my parents, no Italian ancestors at all, but my parents were both, had been to Italy, loved Italy, spoke Italian. It was their secret language when we were children. They exchanged, you know, if they wanted to say things that the children couldn't understand,
Fantastic. They
said it in Italian. So I guess that could have been a little bit of an incentive. But the Sydney degree was very broad-based. It's not like an English degree. I mean, I did philosophy as well. I did French. I was doing all sorts of things.
Now, do you think that's the secret to an educated public who know Goethe as well as Dante, as well as Shakespeare? Because, of course, the British educational system, for many people, they are unlikely in their school time or even in an undergraduate degree if they're studying literature to be studying something outside their own linguistic
and
cultural tradition.
Yeah, it's a hugely difficult question because I went from the Australian system, which was based on the Scottish system, incidentally. It had been imported from Scotland, apparently, to the Italian system, which was entirely different, where you had to do a huge number of subjects to qualify at all. So everyone had to do Latin, geography, history of philosophy, and all sorts of things. Yeah, I was impressed by the good Italian students I met. I had a breadth of knowledge which was completely astonishing to me. But then I started to think about it and I decided that, okay, it swings and roundabouts, there are good things and there are not so good things. I mean, any Italian student could, at the drop of a hat, if you mentioned the name of a philosopher, give you a resume of, you know, period, basic thought, et cetera, et cetera. But it occurred to me that what we'd done in philosophy in Sydney was take a problem and think about it. And they hadn't done that. So although they were, to my mind, immensely knowledgeable and in a very sophisticated way, it wasn't just just rote learning at all. Somehow, at some basic level, they hadn't been taught to think or being taught to think at that point wasn't what the system was requiring of them. So it was very interesting to make the comparison. And when you say, what about A-levels here? Well, you know, it was my despair that my daughters for A-level had to give up a lot of interesting subjects.
Yes, not just the limitation of doing three subjects, but the fact that, for example,
maths,
literature...
Further maths, biology, and chemistry. No literature. No languages.
And even people who do take a literature A-level or who do a degree in English literature. My undergraduate degree was in English literature, and the North American system allows you to choose modules, but... there's not quite so much world literature or the greats, what the French call culture générale is really not as instilled as it
well,
might
be. Well, it's very difficult though, isn't it? Because, I mean, I don't know which is the best system. I used to envy the Italians. They knew history of music. I mean, you know, none of us knew history.
Who has time for that?
None of us knew history of music. And a very dear friend of mine had to do her music exam. And I said... She came out and she said, oh, I think it was okay. And I said, fine, okay, how was it? She said, oh, I bluffed. I thought, okay, if you've been trained in a system where the exams are always oral and you can deflect your examiner to talk about something that you happen to know about, oh, I read an article last week in such and such a magazine, you know, you'll get credit for independence and intelligence and whatever. You may not know all that much about history of music, but that wasn't possible in the subjects I was studying. They were difficult.
So your time in Florence, were you not tempted to stay there, become a lecturer there? I can see how Oxford might have seemed a bit rainy after Florence.
Oxford, the climate of Oxford was dire. It was a terrible shock, but I had a final year to run on my scholarship, and I had said when I applied for it that I wanted to do comparative literature. And it seemed as if going to English and Italian, essentially, and as if going to Oxford was the next logical
step. They've got quite a good university there, right here.
Quite a good university there, yeah. And terrible climate. So that's the way, that's what happened.
And all these years later, you're still here. So you've managed to put up with the climate with occasional bursts of sun.
I go to Italy when I can. Well, back to Australia, not that often, but it's always a joy. I'm a sun lover. I mean, I shouldn't be here. I don't know why I'm in this country.
And the educational environment when you got to Oxford, I know that we've had a nice conversation before about the surprise to an Australian of some kind of elements of snobbery in the ancient universities that seem a bit surprising. And
yes, that's absolutely right.
You mentioned that seeing a grown man address an undergraduate as sir was a bit shocking.
I was going to say, do you want me
shocking.
To tell you that?
Yeah. Yes.
No, that was in the Cambridge University Library, where a middle-aged man addressed a kind of spotty youth, aged 18 at the most, as sir. But then another functionary of the university library, they get their revenge in some odd kind of way. And if you're an outsider, you never get it quite right. And I remember when I went along the very first time, I was over visiting from Oxford and I wanted to use the university library. And I went along and I said, who are you and what do you want? And I said, well, I'm a research student. And he looked at me with utter disdain and said, you mean you're a postgraduate? You know, I'd got the research student, not a phrase we recognize in Cambridge. So there were all sorts of strange things like that.
Strange
pulling of rank and, class system, really, which is to an Australian is anathema. I mean, it just doesn't register, really. So it was water off a duck's back. It didn't really affect me. But I found the middle-aged guy addressing the 18-year-old as sir, that really spooked me. I thought that was creepy.
Was there a similar class system in Florence, where I assume being a Dante scholar a senior Dante scholar would be like being a made man in Italian intellectual circles?
Yeah, I don't think it worked like that at all. The Italian system then, it's changed enormously since then, and I can't really comment on it now, but then, I don't know what I can usefully say, the professors were supreme. They had assistants who carried their briefcases for them and followed them.
A few paces behind.
Exactly, and followed instructions. So that if you wanted any contact with the professor, you did it through an assistente. But on the whole, you didn't really feel brave enough or to have any contact. You just sat at their feet and you tried to get it all down in notes. Very different from the way things work now. We're talking before the invention of the Xerox. We're talking eons ago, Karen.
All right. And you did confess that you were a topo di biblioteca, a little library mouse.
A library mouse, yeah. That was a phrase that was used.
That's a lovely expression. So you sat nibbling at volumes.
Even back in Sydney, I spent a lot of time in the old Fisher Library in Sydney University. I like libraries. Libraries are nice, peaceful places where you can learn an awful lot.
Did you find any kindred spirits there?
Well, I did, but oddly enough, not in the library. I made my two best pals two successive years at the feet of this genius who was lecturing us on Romance philology, but who made no concessions to students at all, and he delivered his lectures at breakneck speed, explained very little, assumed you were clever enough to follow, and the keynotes, the people who really, really cared, and I was one of those, would sit right under his feet at the front because he had a very soft voice as well, and you couldn't hear him if you went too far back. And then at the end of the lecture, we would go away and collate our notes, and between us, we'd got most of it. But no single person could get it all. So I made some very good friends that way.
Sounds like the blind man and the elephant. They're all, I've got the leg, I've got the ear.
No, exactly. I say, I got this, but then I didn't get that last phrase. What was that? But then Silvana or Rosetta would have got that, and we would put it together. So it was a kind of experience of editing texts, which is what I ended up doing, a primitive form of that.
So you are the only non-Italian to edit an Edizione Nazionale of a Dante text.
That's true, Karen.
That is, even to a non-expert like me, that sounds faintly astonishing. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that the Società Dantesca Italiana would use Italian scholars.
They mostly do. How did it happen? It happened by a process of accretion, because the text that I edited is the Monarchia. Which is his treatise on political thought in medieval Latin. And the thesis I did in Florence for this terrifying professor, given to me by him, he gave me the subject, was an edition of the earliest translation into Italian of this text. And it was done in the 15th century, very incompetently, and it's an anonymous translation. We don't know who did it. So I did that.
Slapdash job.
He didn't really understand what he was translating, right. So it was, yeah.
We've all had that feeling.
So I did that. And then I looked at the next, out of pure curiosity, I looked at the next translation that was done, which was done by the great Marsilio Ficino, who's the Plato specialist and philosopher who did his translation in 1467, so that's a few years later. And I realized that the editions of that were rubbish. I mean, they went back to 19th century editions, and nobody had looked at the manuscripts. So I went back to the manuscripts, so there were 7 or 8 manuscripts. And that was the next thing I did, was I edited that. So I was establishing a certain kind of, shall we say, presence as somebody who knew a little bit about the Monarchia. And then I was asked to do other things. Always, when manuscripts came to light, I was asked to describe them and so on. And then I was asked, still by this professor, this amazing professor, he finally said, and he was the president of the Società Dantesca by now, and he said, would you like to do an edition for us, a new edition? Because I'd criticized it had become clear that the previous edition was obviously very good in some respects, but that there were things about it that were not right, and that it really, one needed to go back to the manuscripts and think about it again. This is the kind of subject that I think my students wouldn't be interested in, and this is why I've changed direction completely to write a book about something that is more accessible, because I've spent most of my life doing this kind of detailed textual work, which I love. I love working with manuscripts.
But this kind of essential work, feeling that you, as a scholar, are putting a quite important brick in the wall marked.
Absolutely.
The body of knowledge about Dante must be enormously satisfying.
It's very satisfying. It is, yeah. But not a lot of people out there really get it or understand why it would be. I mean, I can just remind you, I mean, I'm sure you know this, Karen, but we don't have, Dante's obviously well before the invention of printing, so all surviving copies of Dante's works are manuscript. No two manuscripts are identical. So to establish a text, you have to look at all the surviving evidence, early printed editions as well, but because they may be based on manuscripts that are no longer surviving. But, and it's a fascinating intellectual problem to go back, to look at the evidence and try and work, devise a hypothesis that explains the relationships of the surviving manuscripts, and then to work back from that to establish what the text is. And that's what I was doing.
It sounds like a very long and painstaking process.
Yeah, it was decades.
And how did you combine this with teaching? Because, of course, the constant balance for an academic teaching and research.
With great difficulty. And administration, of course, was the other big thing in academic life.
Things come in threes, as Dante said.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. No, it was very difficult. One just, you know, sort of soldiered on with one's research, assuming that at some point in the very distant future, something would emerge from what you were doing. It's much easier now to work on manuscripts because, of course, with digitized images, we have high-quality digitized images now, and you don't actually necessarily have to go to the library.
To
but
the
when I started, it was the head into the microfilm reader, reading these not necessarily very good copies on microfilm, and then I felt an obligation. I had to go and look at the manuscript itself because I didn't think the microfilm was necessarily a completely accurate representation, but now we're getting these astonishingly beautiful and legible images. And one of the big projects I've done, I don't know whether you've taken that on board,
yes,
not working on the Monarchia, just
the
a change
digital edition of the
Commedia.
And I wanted to ask you about that project because, of course, digital humanities is a buzz phrase in our
buzz
pages,
phrase.
But
yeah,
for very good reason.
Yeah.
And you must really feel there that you are contributing to something that expands the potential reach to scholars around the world.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in all sorts of different ways, but it does come back to the general reader as well, actually, because by giving on that DVD, we have 7 manuscripts, and we've got beautiful digitized images of every page of every manuscript there, so that anyone who has it can have access to it. And it's like reading Dante 15 years after his death. This is what a reader, these are manuscripts dating from 1336, 1337. Dante dies in 1321, so we're not that far away from him. I think it's incredibly exciting and actually very moving to be able to read the text in that form. So that's the public aspect, if you like, is making that sort of material accessible. But there's also a very scholarly dimension to it, which is looking at a hypothesis that a scholar had produced about the interrelationships between these particular 7 manuscripts, and using digital resources, programs that had been devised by my collaborator, Peter Robinson, to test whether we thought his hypothesis was accurate. The previous editor, the great Giorgio Petrocchi, had thought differently, and we came down very clearly with the view that Petrocchi was right and that the later person was wrong. But that was actually using digital techniques, using digital
being
programs.
Able to compare the versions of the manuscripts?
You can do that, obviously, by hand, but it's an immensely painstaking thing. And what my collaborator had devised were programs which enabled you to do some of those kinds of things much more quickly. I mean, there was enormously lengthy preparation of transcribing the manuscripts and making sure they were absolutely accurate, and then adapting them to suit his program. So we had a whole team working on it. This wasn't just 2 of us. We had funding, and it's one of the best things, I think, that the digital, if I blow my own trumpet at this point, or our trumpet, it's one of the best things that I think the digital humanities have produced in this country, although obviously it's more interesting in some ways to Italians than it might be to English people.
How did it become a project done in the UK rather than in Italy?
Well, because I was fascinated with Dante manuscripts, I always have been, and these early manuscripts of the Commedia are really very beautiful and very interesting. And this person I was collaborating with, I'd collaborated with him on the Monarchia, and between us we came up with this plan. Other people were involved as well. I don't want to take the credit for it. You know, it was a group thing. But it seemed as if it was a very interesting way of using digital humanities, which we're talking back in, I think, 1998, 1999 is when we got started. So quite a long time ago.
Yes.
And things have moved on dramatically in terms of computer power and so on. It's all much faster now than it was then. But we just thought there was enormous potential, and we put in a funding application, and we were given funding. To start with, not for the whole poem, but then later we got the rest of the poem.
The possibility for democratization of scholarship seems enormous.
Well, it was. Well, that's true as well. That people
coming
can
from
read,
Australia, where an Australian scholar couldn't easily pop over to a library Florence.
No.
The fact that now a DVD will.
That's true. That is true. Yeah.
Do you think it will level the playing field for scholars further away?
Well,
a little.
It's very, very interesting because the question now is, where do we move on with this project? We have 7 manuscripts. There are 800 manuscripts of the comedy.
I see. So, are they on your to-do list, Prue?
It could be. It should be on somebody's to-do list to get
volunteered.
Them all in. But some people are skeptical. About whether it's feasible, really, there was a lot of manpower involved. We had a team of people who were transcribing, and we were checking the transcriptions. And you'd have, and we trained people up and they were very good, brilliant actually, and it would be possible to do it. And I think, you know, one at a time, one could knock off more manuscripts and add them to the database, and it would be a completely wonderful thing to do. So far, we haven't managed to. Well, I've been writing this book. You know, I've had a gap of a few years. I took time off from the computing bit of it while I did this, but I'm quite keen to get back to it to see where we could go with it.
And presumably, scholars elsewhere seeing the benefit of it, it just adds to the feeling around the world that there is an advantage.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope people would see how exciting it is. How exciting the possibilities are. It's not in any way a substitute for traditional scholarship and the rigors of traditional scholarship, but it's an extension. It's just something else that's interesting and that you can do. And time-saving in some ways. But I think you have to be a rigorously trained scholar to be able to use the digital resources. I don't think you can just come in and think the digital
pop
resources.
On the DVD.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, this is easy. Anyone can do this with images and whatever. I think that absolutely isn't true.
Well, I don't want to give away the ending of The Divine Comedy, but I did rather feel that it was a bit of a Shaggy Dog story when Dante goes through all of this journey and there's no man with a beard at the end. What's the three things with rainbows? Yeah. Come on, Prue, explain this.
Well,
should I be disappointed?
No, I mean, Dante has the vision of God at the end of the poem, it's true, but what he doesn't have is Michelangelo's elderly bearded figure putting his hand out to Adam. And I think some people do find that, well, surprising, shall we say. Not necessarily disappointing. I think if you followed the story up to there and followed those amazing final four cantos where he's getting closer and closer and his capacity to see is being transformed, beyond what human beings can normally do, and it has to be transformed in order for him to be able to have the vision of God at the end. And what he sees is light, essentially, but then as you rightly say, he also sees the three circles. And what he has there, very briefly, is an intuition of the mystery of the Trinity, but he doesn't explain it to us. Because he can't explain it to us. It's beyond human comprehension. But he, for a moment, sees it. And that's the moment of vision that we have at the end of the poem. And along with that, in one of the circles, he sees a human face. And that's the other central Christian mystery of the human and divine nature of Christ. So Dante intuits it at the end of the poem. I don't think it's disappointing. It's not an old man with a beard. But I think it's pretty astounding.
I wonder if you might like to someone who has not heard Dante in the Italian and may not even speak Italian, a few lines that you love, the sound of even, that we might hear and think, I've got to go read this.
Okay, I'm going to... I'll quote the ones that Bertolucci quoted. We've come full circle and I come round to Bertolucci quoting these lines on Start the Week. This is Ulysses speaking, and it's very problematical and paradoxical because Ulysses is in hell, but these are lines that he's speaking to his companions, urging them to accompany him on his last voyage, which we will later learn, but we know because he's in hell that it must be the case,
must
that it's an infraction of the divine will that he do this. But he uses this wonderful rhetoric to urge them on. And the key to that is, considerate la vostra semenza, fatti non foste a viver come bruti, ma per seguir virtute e conoscenza. Consider your origin. You weren't made to live like beasts, but to pursue virtue and knowledge. And can I just end on a little point? That Primo Levi in Auschwitz kept himself sane by trying to reconstruct Ulysses' speech from memory.
Prue, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Karen. It's been a pleasure.